away.
I'm sorry, Harry, I couldn't hear you. Somebody was interfering.
That's all right. I just said send us some of your rain.
Yeah. Hey, I will. You are in a desert, Harry.
I know, but it's supposed to rain a little.
I know.
Good morning, everybody.
Morning.
Good morning.
Morning.
Good morning. Hey, Jeff.
Hey. How was your trip to Michigan? Everybody stayed healthy?
Everybody stayed healthy. The weather was perfect. And
awesome.
It was, it was a good time.
Good.
We mostly ate outside or had a picnic and, rode bikes and...
Cool.
It's so pretty up northern Michigan's so pretty. We were, Mackinac Island and Petoskey, and it's just really pretty up there.
Yep, it is.
Oh, we just went there too.
Oh, you did?
We did. The most lovely.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Can
all right. Well,
you?
Maybe we'll get. What?
Oh, sorry. Time to get started.
That's her. All right. Time to get started. All right. Well, good morning, everybody. This is the August Journal Club. Thanks for meeting a week early. I'm hoping to not be at work next week at this time. So the first article is by Joanne and the folks in Rochester, Jay Rue. Joanne was hoping she could be here, but she's in the frozen section lab, so was unable to be here. Some of the studies looking at cryptogenic organizing pneumonia have been only looked at cryptogenic cases like SAMS, and others have looked at this as a pattern, and that's kind of the basis of CHERD study. This is looking at cicatricial or fibrosing organizing pneumonia as a pattern. And then as the methods will show, they compare those with less than 10% of this feature to those that are more than 10%. And Joanne, I think, when sent me a note, one of the things they were trying to do was to use the series from one institution rather than from consults, and that's something you can do in Rochester for sure. So they looked at pooled cases of organizing pneumonia from 2005 to 2013. They excluded cases for a variety of reasons, some were associated with infection and so on, and ended up with 56 cases. They were all evaluated for the percent collagen deposition, presence of linear fibrous bands mimicking fibrotic MSIP, and the presence of ossification. They reviewed the clinical histories, and then it's not clear to me, but they picked greater and less than 10% for one part of the analysis, and then they picked those with greater than 50% for kind of a deep dive. So we'll go over kind of both of those. So 32 or almost 60% showed greater than 10% cicatricial foci, and 9 had greater than 50%, so 16%, greater than 50% foci of cicatricial organizing pneumonia. Among those with greater than 10%, almost 80% were cryptogenic, while the rest were secondary. Of the 50, the greater than 50% cases, 9 showed these linear fibrous bands that probably some of you have also seen. And 5 of 9 showed intraluminal ossification. And part of, I think, Joanne's point about the paper was some areas superficially mimicked fibroblast foci of UIP. There's two tables, which I have not reproduced, but they give the clinical and radiologic characteristics. Table 1 has the entire group with the 10% cutoff. In those that are greater than 10%, which I think are the more significant group, 27 men, 5 women, broad age range like you'd expect for organizing pneumonia. Those with secondary causes included CTD, including an adult stills, proximal airway obstruction due to tumor. I'm not quite sure why that ended up in here. I would have probably thrown that one out, but anyway. Myelodysplastic syndrome and then others. I'm going to jump down to the next bullet. The follow-up CT showed that only 10% of patients with OP greater than 10% did worse, which was pretty similar to those that had less than 10% cicatricial component. So as you'll recall, in Sam's original paper, he indicated that these patients did worse than the average patient with BOOP, whereas those with, you know, cicatricial in this study didn't seem to necessarily do worse. Table 2 highlights the 9 patients with greater than 50% cicatricial component. There were 7 men and 2 women. 7 were cryptogenic, 1 had RA, and 1 was due to aspiration. Interestingly, 6 out of 9 didn't have any significant symptoms. So hard to argue with doing worse, I guess, without any symptoms. So the authors emphasized that in 16% of their cases, when it was present, it was accompanied by linear fibrous bands reminiscent of UIP, and some of these were also associated with areas of ossification. Many of these patients didn't have any significant symptoms. And on follow-up, 6 of 9 of the patients with greater than 50% were alive or had stable disease. The other 3 that had died did not die because of the fibrosing OP. They briefly discussed in the discussion the challenges of differentiating this pattern of BOOP from fibrotic NSIP and UIP, and discuss a bit about whether this could really represent some sort of an overlap, and they kind of dismissed that, I think, in part based on imaging and those sorts of things. They speculate on the differences between this study and the other ones and highlight the fact that, as I mentioned, they looked at one institution and picked out their cases of all comers in, you know, in a large case series. So this is another study focusing on cicatricial OP as a pattern. The design, I think, was good in that they pulled all the OP cases for a given time. They do break out this small group with greater than 10% that doesn't seem to do worse, which is sort of similar to Andy's findings, but not those of Sam. So open for discussion.
So this is Andras. So Harry, you consider Sam's paper is the original one? That was a paper from England in 2013 with a title, Fibrosing Organizing Pneumonia. And,
go ahead.
I don't know whether it's referenced by Joanne's and her co-investigators, but the earlier...
Now, I'd have to look at the references. I guess those are the 2 studies that I tend to think about the most, but there may be, and I know there are some other small series as well, so I didn't mean to exclude other studies from my mention, so, but I have her paper here. Let's see.
This one from England is written by Berkeley and Russell.
Actually, I'm not. She's only got 14 references. Mary Beth had Beth Beardsley. Sorry, it's Beardsley, and I always make that mistake. So maybe that's the one you're talking about.
Yes.
Beardsley from England, Fibrosing OP, Journal of Clinical Pathology in 2013. Yeah.
Yep.
I think that was only a couple of cases, though, as I recall.
I'm not sure about that.
They actually reviewed organizing pneumonia in general and included fibrosing organizing pneumonia among several patterns.
So I think,
Henry,
you
I
know,
had a question.
Yeah.
4 of these cases are just nodules. To compare those to even think that a nodule would enter into the differential of UIP, to me, didn't make any sense. And if 4 are nodules and 1 are mask-like opacities, you really only have 4 cases that are comparable to other sorts of diffuse ILD. So this is actually a pretty small series.
Agree. I mean, I think, but I think, Tom, most, you know, as we all know from consults, while we might look at the x-rays and go, well, there's no way this is a fibrosing IP because there's a nodule or a consolidation, a lot of pathologists, you know, don't take the time or don't have the availability of looking at the imaging and, you know, end up down the rabbit hole of thinking this is a fibrotic lung disease.
True. Does anybody remember whether Sam's cases were localized or were they all sort of diffuse? I don't remember.
Yeah, I don't know. It's been a while since I've pulled the actual paper. All right. If there's no other comments or questions, I'll move on. So the next study was a large study out of Central Europe looking at, excuse me, the prognostic significance of architecture, cytology, mitotic activity, and necrosis in epithelioid malignant mesotheliomas. As you're probably aware, there have been some move to suggest that with all mesos, we should be grading that all epithelioid mesos, we should be grading them. So this study was to look at another way of grading them and another way of combining those features to come up with a grade. So there were a total of 192 patients. They had a training set, which I won't read all of the types of samples, but there were a variety of sample types, and then a validation set that was a digital archive, which was out of the Cancer Genome Atlas, something I was not familiar with. They took one H&E section provided by the participating center, and two of the authors classified the tumors into the predominant growth pattern, the presence of pleomorphic features, and then the patterns that they looked at were tubular papillary, solid, trabecular, microcystic, micropapillary. The mitotic activity was based on hotspots, and then they calculated the mitosis necrosis score, and there's a reference there for that particular way of doing it, and then did the usual, you know, Kaplan-Meier and overall survival, et cetera. So in the results, they had a very low number of micropapillary variants, so they excluded those from the survival analysis. Tubular papillary and microcystic were associated with a better survival. Solid and trabecular had shorter survivals. Pleomorphic had the shortest and was significantly worse than tubular papillary, microcystic, and solid, and showed a trend towards worse outcome than predominantly trabecular. Patients with the mitosis necrosis scores, that turned out to also be significant. So the 1, 2, and 3 score had overall survival of 720. If you had a score of 1, 386 for 2, and 165 days for 3, all of those being highly significant. There weren't any significant differences between nuclear grades 1 and 2, however. The presence of necrosis was also associated with significantly shorter survival compared to those without. And then they did their validation cohort, and just in summary, that supported the overall findings that they made in the training set. Then they, a little different than a couple of the other larger studies that have looked at grading of mesotheliomas, they tried to figure out what the impact of the subtypes was in multimodal, you know, in those patients who received some sort of multimodal therapy or MMT. So among those patients who had MMT, tubular papillary microcystic patients did better than those with the solid or trabecular pattern. And among those not receiving any therapy, there was no significant difference between these two main groups, indicating that, you know, therapy for these groups might be indicated. So the authors point out that this is the second largest study to evaluate the prognostic role of different histologic patterns in epithelioid mesos, and the first to directly compare the prognostic impact, nuclear grade, and the mitotic score when they've been treated. Confirms that microcystic and tubular papillary are associated with the best survival. Trabecular had a poor prognosis, similar to solid, but that's not a uniform finding in the literature. In multivariate analysis, the MN score was a single independent prognostic factor, but there was also a significant association between solid and trabecular and higher MN scores and higher nuclear grades, so they kind of seem to co-vary. While nuclear grade 3 tumors showed a significant shorter overall survival, they found no significant overall survival between nuclear grades 1 and 2, supporting the recommendations from the EUROCAN and IASLC proposal for a two-tier rather than a three-tier grading system. It's probably worth taking a look at the survival curves. They emphasize the results visually, and they support the value in grading mesos, although, you know, no one's ever asked me for one when I haven't done it. I'd kind of be interested in others' experience. I have started, just as a matter of record, grading my epithelioid mesos, but if I don't, nobody seems to care either way. So I don't know what everybody else's experience has been.
Yeah, I don't think we grade them here. I was wondering, maybe I missed that, did they ever look in the reproducibility of the grading? I mean, do we know how we actually do with that?
No. And I don't think any of the prior studies have done that. I think, no.
Yeah, I thought Elaine had looked into that once, but I think it was all within their own institution. But I might not remember correctly either.
Anya, can I ask, you mentioned you grade them there. We don't grade them.
No, No.
You do or
don't? She says she doesn't.
Oh, you don't. Okay. You know, I've started asking our oncologists about some of the things that we're all agreed are really important, like micropapillary patterns in lung cancer and those various things, and asked them how much of that information is actionable on their side. And the answer is none of it. So I think when we say things are critically important, I think we sometimes don't connect that to what happens next, like what's clinically actionable. And a lot of it simply isn't. We're talking to ourselves.
Yeah. Right.
That doesn't mean it isn't important. It just means that nobody cares.
Just means it isn't important.
Yep, that's right. All right. Everybody there?
I'm here.
All right.
Thanks. Going back to Tom's question on that prior cicatricial, the Yosem paper, they just said diffuse bilateral, but then they describe it as either nodular or reticulonodular, but they said it was bilateral in their cases.
Thanks. All right. We'll go on to the next paper if there's no other questions. All right. The next study is by Anders Nicholson's group looking at invasive mucinous adenocarcinomas. So there have been very few studies looking at the various patterns of invasive mucinous, and then they also include mixed invasive mucinous, non-mucinous, so MMNA. They have 84 IMAs and 41 MMNAs, and much like the predominant patterns in non-mucinous tumors, they classify them as lipidic, acin, or papillary solid, micropapillary, and cribriform. They also looked at other morphologic features, all of which I won't read, but the typical ones you might look for, including things like staph. And then they also recorded the total size and the invasive size. So for those that had a significant lipidic component, they, of course, that's going to change the tumor size. For non-mucinous for mucinous with, I think there's a typo there, with multiple foci of invasion like you're supposed to do with the non-mucinous, they took the total size times the percentage of non-lipidic invasive components to determine the type of, or the overall degree of invasion. Then they did an adjusted T stage using the invasive size only. And then to determine which features were to be included in the new grading system, they looked at disease-free survival and overall survival with less than 0.07 considered significant. Not sure why that was chosen as opposed to the standard 0.05, but statistics are always somewhat beyond me, so there you have it. They ended up with five features as being significant: architecture, atypia, mitotic figures, mitotic activity, necrosis, and lymphocytic invasion. And then they devised the scoring scheme that's there. When you add up all of those, you get a score of low grade or high grade, as shown in that second little table. So this is, there's like so much data in this study, it really is kind of mind-boggling. So feel free to look at the detailed long tables. I did not spend much time on them, I'll tell you. For looking at the association between pattern and clinical pathologic features, tumors with less than 10% lipidic were more likely to show increased mitotic activity, vascular invasion, and nodal mets, while those with greater than 10% acinar were also associated with nodal metastases. Greater than 10% micropapillary showed greater stasis and lymphovascular invasion. Greater than 10% cribriform were associated with pleural and invasion and lymphovascular invasion and nodal metastases. As you might expect, when they did their adjusted T stage, and I'm not going to read the numbers there, but a significant proportion of their cases were staged down, right, because they're not accounting for the non-invasive lipidic component. High-grade tumors, which turned out to be those that were micropapillary and cribriform, were significantly associated with pleural invasion, nodal mets, higher adjusted T stage, and TNM stage. In looking at the differences between their invasive, mucinous, and then the mixed, there was no significant prognostic difference between the purely invasive and the mixed mucinous, although the pure invasive mucinous had a worse disease-free survival within 5 years. And the mixed showed that had a DFS and an OS that was somewhere between the low and the high-grade invasive mucinous adenocarcinomas. If we look just at the invasive mucinous, the disease-free survival was significantly associated with the T stage. The adjusted T stage using the invasive size was also significantly associated with the poor overall survival, but not disease-free survival. There's, like I said, there's so much data. I may have misspoken here. It was, now I'm reading this. Adjusted T stage using invasive size significantly associated with poor overall but not DFS. And the non-adjusted, I don't know. I'll have to review that later and update this. I may have misspoken there. Higher pathologic grade was associated with the poor overall survival but not disease-free survival. The total size was associated with the poor disease-free survival. Like I said, anyone else is free to look at these tables and pull out what might be significant here. In
or
summary,
actionable.
The authors show that... Pardon?
Or actionable.
Fair enough, yes. The authors show that a two-tier grading system stratifies mucinous into two groups. They suggest that remeasuring tumors along the lines of what is currently being done in the current staging system will refine the T-category stratification. The results of the mixed mucinous analysis didn't really show significant prognostic differences, although they showed a slightly better disease-free survival at 5 years. Also, the mixed ones developed extrapulmonary mets more often than the invasive mucinous, whereas the latter tended to develop intrapulmonary mets. So, you know, if you think about the mucinous tumors as being sort of the BACs, they often stay localized to the lung but spread in the lung, and then if you've got other sorts of variants in there, they tend to behave more like regular adenocarcinomas. The authors discuss the limitations of using overall rather than disease-free survival and inter-observer agreement challenges. So I sort of like this study. It's one of the few studies digging deeper into these mucinous and mixed tumors, And I guess on the mixed tumors, I usually ended up plugging those into the mucinous, whether that's right or wrong, you know. But at least somebody sort of pointed out that there's this challenge. So I kind of think the approach probably makes sense if we think any of it's significant. Comments?
It would be an interesting proposition trying to figure out what is staphs in an invasive mucinous carcinoma.
A similar question. So you said that they used these architecture patterns, right, including lapidic, to characterize both invasive mucinous and mixed. So in my mind, lapidic would never apply to mucinous. I mean, I know a lot of them have a sort of a lapidic pattern, but I my impression was we shouldn't use lapidic for mucinous. So my question is, when they characterized the invasive mucinous adenocarcinomas, their definition shouldn't include any mixed non-mucinous component. Did they still use the lapidic description?
Well, I mean, this was done in the context of a study, so they're defining lapidic outside of the WHO, you know, criteria for when you would use that term, right? They're talking about that growth pattern that frequently we see and why these are, you know, many of these used to be called mucinous BACs because they tend to grow and look like they're floating often in, you know, long alveolar septa.
Hey,
I don't know if I've answered your question or not, Andras.
Yeah, I mean, it does. To me, it's just confusing.
I think the authors, I mean, I don't, maybe overall survival is a better measure than disease-free survival, but I always assumed that disease-free survival was a better measure of disease biology. Maybe that's not true. But what interests me is, your summary comment, which I think is accurate, that it turns out the best association with disease-free survival is simply gross tumor measurement, which is what we've always done, right? And if you compare their figure 2C, which is the unadjusted, with figure 2E, which is the adjusted, it's hard to look at 2E and say that's an advance because the patients with T3, T4 disease are kind of in the middle. Those with T2A disease are doing worse. And if you look at 2C, that's pretty good separation, right? So I can't tell if we're moving forward, backward, or just staying the same.
and making it significantly more challenging to make a diagnosis.
Yeah, and I'm
yeah,
not
thanks,
trying to be
thanks,
a Luddite,
yeah.
but I just can't tell.
Yeah, well, I think this is one of the first studies to really look at this group in this way, so some of us need to be doing more studies like this. But it might be above my pay grade. I don't know. Certainly the statistics are.
Yeah, mine too.
Oh, I don't know about that. I like the way you just framed that. All right. I'll dive into the next one, you know, with a little bit of trepidation because I can hardly say all the words, but like next generation sequencing and, you know, Sanger, because it's like right at the limit of my knowledge. But I thought that the summary of this case or the summary of this was worth talking about. So especially because I know a lot of the folks who are on the line, our Rochester group, are particularly interested in the challenge of multiple adenocarcinomas. So, you know, in the most recent staging system, adenocarcinoma demonstrating lapidic predominant morphology are considered independent or multiple primaries despite the fact that they have matching histology because they're supposed to not metastasize, right? The CAP, the IASLC, and AMP don't require testing, molecular testing when all tumors are seemingly similar. So this study examined the degree of concordance between morphology and molecular testing among synchronous pulmonary adenocarcinomas using a variety of molecular techniques, and they're kind of broken down by two time periods within the in how they used to do this at their institution. So they took all consecutive non-small cell lung carcinomas with more than one nodule who had available molecular testing. And molecular testing was done by standard protocols using, as I said, a combination of immunohistochemistry, FISH, Sanger sequencing, and NGS. And broadly speaking, they had a concordant group and a discordant group. So the concordant groups were those that had the same histology and the identical driver mutation, or a different histology with a different driver mutation, or with one tumor lacking an identifiable oncogenic driver. So they've made an assumption there. The discordant group, tumors with the same histology but different drivers, or one lacking an identifiable driver, so they would be able to have the wild type, or tumors with different histologies but sharing identical drivers. So again, you know, I don't know if that's the right way to say it's discordant or not. All discordant cases were then reviewed to determine whether the initial diagnoses were correct by comprehensive histologic assessment. I'm not going to read the exact way they did the panels, but for those of you who follow all of that, you can take a look at that. The pathologic stage in clinical follow-up, they used the highest T stage when T3 or higher was assigned based on morphology and or molecular results. The tumors were categorized as T3, T4, M1A when there was a similar histology or molecular profiles were present in tumors in the same lobe, different ipsilateral lobes or contralateral lobes respectively, so T3, 4, and M1A. In cases with dissimilar histology, the T score was based on the AJCC criteria. They had to have at least 4 months of follow-up for clinical analysis. So they had 47 cases representing 44 patients who had at least two tumors, and all tumors, kind of by definition, were adenocarcinomas. 14 patients had similar histology. 30 had different histology with multifocal adenocarcinomas with lipidic predominant morphology in three of the other patients. The results for 108 individual tumors were sequenced using a combination of non-NGS and NGS formats. Overall, the molecular testing without CMR is comprehensive molecular review were informative. So about 50% of the cases had informative, and among those, 75% had informative comparisons in the entire cohort, and among only NGS cases, 96% were informative, so a better tool. 53% were concordant, while 21% were discordant between the morphologic and molecular classification. 26% were indeterminate. And then they re-reviewed some of the discordant cases, and 70% were still discordant. So based on molecular testing, 5 patients were upstaged to a T3, and 5 were downstaged from T3. So in the current guidelines, there's no uniformly accepted way to address the role of molecular testing in the presence of multiple synchronous tumors. Their morphologic assessment, they had 53% concordance and 21% discordance between morphologic and molecular classification, and there were still a significant proportion which were indeterminate, similar to prior studies. Morphologic reassessment revised the results in 3 of the discordant cases. So the study demonstrates that the decision to stage by histology or molecular results may have significant clinical impact. That is, patients with tumor of different histology but identical molecular testing. We're not always referred to medical oncology and therefore didn't receive potentially beneficial adjuvant chemotherapy. And in discordant cases with the same histology and different molecular results, the patients may have unnecessarily been treated. So I think this study argues for the importance of molecular testing when dealing with synchronous primary tumors, kind of regardless of what they look like. So I don't know if Jen is on or Anya, if MC is on. Any thoughts?
Yeah, but we don't do that right now. I mean, we are still waiting for the mate pair, which MC had studied and which seemed to be very valuable in that circumstance. And they tried to put it for paraffin sections, and I think they still validate that technique.
It's hard to tell from this paper that getting it right mattered. They make the argument that it matters in terms of how they get treated, but not in terms of their disease biology. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
When you look at their outcome data, it's hard to get excited that this is as critically important as they say. I get their point that it's important to get it right because they'll be treated differently, but that's not the same as a difference in outcome.
Yes.
And I think, Anya, isn't it true that that's been shown in other studies that that in terms of separating T3 patients in this context, the histology is about as effective in predicting outcome as molecular. Is that true?
I have to admit, I don't know the exact data on that, Jeff.
Yeah, so that'll be my homework.
Yep.
I have a real problem with these cases. Hi, sorry, it's Margaret here. You know, the multifocal lipidic predominance is supposed to be another whole separate type of animal. But, you know, a lot of these tumors have some lipidic, some papillary, some this and that. They're not necessarily lipidic predominant. And why can't they just be that lipidic predominant animal that has just progressed further with more invasive areas? And, you know, we're just dealing with a patient who just developed these tumors. And they're not necessarily metastases. Am I making myself clear? Do you understand what I'm trying to get at?
Yeah, I mean, that's, actually, I had a similar question. If you have two lipidic predominant tumors, then and if the molecular profiles are different, then would you consider them one primary and one MET? I mean,
no, I think they would consider, well, in this study, they would consider them two separate tumors rather than one.
So if you have two lipidic with two different molecular profiles, that would be two separate tumors still?
I believe so.
But it would still be staged on the worst tumor, right? So it wouldn't upstage it. Yeah. But say you have multiple lipidic tumors and you don't have molecular profiling available, you do regard these as just multiple synchronous tumors, and they're not regarded as metastases.
Well, I think the point here is that there's some of those that actually do have the same molecular profile, and therefore one may represent a metastasis. That's their argument, as I understand it.
So
you know,
Harry or anyone else, in your clinical practice, if you have two lipidic predominant tumors, just based on the histology for staging purposes, you would consider them two primaries?
Yes.
Yeah, because they're lipidic predominant. Yeah, so they're kind of different, aren't they? Because normally you'd think they would all be metastases because they've got the same histology. but they're not because they're the multifocal lipidic predominant type tumors. But then why can't these other tumors that are not lipidic predominant just be the same tumors that have progressed further and they've been removed now because they're solid? You know, a lot of these are just watched and not removed until they become solid.
So, yeah, I mean, I think that's part. Go ahead.
Just to go back to the basics, so your algorithm is when you have two separate tumors, you look at them, and if they are both lipidic predominant, you would consider them two primaries. And if they are not lipidic predominant, then you would do this 5% increment pattern assessment and base your primary or MET assessment on the patterns of each.
I think that's what we're supposed to do, aren't we? Those are the general directions at the moment.
So you do a histologic pattern assessment in 5% increments, and then I'm sorry for my ignorance, but then how much difference do you want to call them two separate primaries?
Like, I don't know. That's the trouble.
10%, 15%, 20%.
It's so subjective. Yeah, it's so subjective.
Yeah.
What other people do.
Just another question. Does anybody know how often a lung cancer acquires a new mutation when you study, say, the lymph node MET as opposed to the primary?
Well, the driving mutations shouldn't change. EGFR, KRAS should all be the same. Unless
okay, so we don't worry about tumor heterogeneity in lung cancer, then?
I guess not in a molecular sense. Yeah.
Well, I think that's why the sequencing by itself is insufficient, right? So you kind of have to go further in potentially these cases. But I think
maybe we should do sequencing at 5% intervals.
My head's starting to hurt. Are we done?
All right. Yeah, I'm going to start at the end of the end of my summary because I have to toot my own little horn here. Take a look at the images from the case report on two patients with heavy print toner and paper dust exposure. One of these patients has four-color toner in her lung. It's just spectacular. So that's number 13 on the case reports and reviews. A lot of the rest of the articles in here are related to COVID, so they're, you know, worth taking a look at. The vascular thrombotic tendency in these patients is significant, and there's a nice paper in the New England Journal. Lita Harari has an editorial. There's a large series of papers in seminars in diagnostic pathology on mediastinal disease, mostly based on cytology, so I did not really review any of those or have a lot of comments, but you can take a look at those if you need good references. Some stuff on thymomas. I thought there was a New England Journal, so number 9 by Gaeta, it's one of the New England Journal case reports or cases. They have a bunch of freestanding tents that they were using outside of some of the Boston hospitals to house the COVID patients. I thought it was just kind of remarkable, you know, in this day and age of what we're having to do to take care of patients. And then the last paper is looking at IgG4-related disease, and they're proposing some criteria for how to exclude mimickers of IgG4-related disease. So you might want to take a look at that one. I included the exclusion criteria as the last table on the summary. So I think we're at 7 o'clock. Thank you, everybody.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Henry.
Thank you,
Thanks, Henry.
Bye.
Bye-bye.